Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Oh, hi, me again. But I'm not going to whisper this time because I find it gross when I hear it back. You're going to be getting a few of these between now and the end of the Edinburgh Fringe, and I can only apologize. This is for everyone on the South Coast near Brighton, because I will be at the Brighton Fringe on 3 dates across the next few weeks. Tomorrow, Wednesday, the 8th of May, you probably can't make that one, but what if you just happen to be living in Hove thinking, what should I do on Wednesday night? You're going to come see me. Can't make that one? Not a big deal. I'll also be at the Brighton Fringe on Tuesday, May 14th, and the following Tuesday, May 21st. I don't know exactly what time. Between 7 and 8, you're just going to Google Brighton Fringe, Sarah Barron. You're going to get the details. You're going to come watch a lady do a little kind of messy thing, but in a fun way as I get this show together.
Did you have a nice birthday?
Yeah, I did have a nice birthday.
Your present was a replacement orthopedic pillow.
Which means I lost an orthopedic pillow.
Now, you may be listening to this thinking, but how do you lose a pillow?
I've noticed that when I travel for work, a shitty pillow can really fuck you. So I just love having my pillow. It soothes me. And so I travel always with my orthopedic pillow. And the weird thing that happened, I mean, I want to say at this stage, like 4 months ago, suddenly my orthopedic pillow was missing. Now, this is a weird thing. It's weird to get into bed at night and be like, where's my pillow?
Because it's not a dinky little pillow either.
It's a hefty little man. He's sturdy. It's a sturdy, big pillow. And it wasn't like I went away for work. I took my orthopedic pillow. I was getting into my own bed the following night and I went, fuck, I left my pillow at the hotel. That didn't happen. I must be misremembering. But the way that I remember it is like, it was a regular night. I went to bed in my own bed. Next night, got back in my bed and my pillow was gone forever.
Do you suspect foul play?
No. So I got this new pillow and I am a woman reborn.
I would say that the orthopedic pillow gets to spend more time with you than I do.
I don't think that's right. It provides a greater sense of comfort than you do. Like, you're a live wire when we're sleeping. I don't know what's going to happen. Is he snoring tonight? Is it just a heavy breathing? Do you want to cuddle me more than I want to be cuddled? Are you doing a little moving that you sometimes do? Could it be one of the couple nights a week where you do a little shouting in the nighttime? And those, like, what's going to happen next is not a soothing energy for somebody. Whereas my pillow is just like, I know what he's up to. He's there to support me through my night.
So in some ways you prefer it to me.
I guess, but I just want to say, like, losing it wasn't a big deal. And if you died, it would, like, negatively affect me quite seriously. So I choose you.
That's lovely, sweetheart.
Thank you.
Thank you. We should talk about the episode.
Yeah, let's talk about it.
So the first thing to say is this week is a cineast special.
Oh, cineasts. Oh my gosh, cineasts. A guy said to me the word cineast when I was 18, like a fucking douchebag guy. And I went, oh, I don't know what that means. And he went, sorry, I didn't realize people here didn't know what that means. So rude.
But here you are, later in life, a cineast, because we've accidentally ended up watching all films this week.
And I had to convince Jeff that that was acceptable, because two of the three somehow are going to go down in history
as the greatest films I've ever watched in my life. And I was thinking, I owed it to you to say your life will be emptier if you don't sit on your sofa and experience these two films.
Are you not worried that we're treading on Kermode and Mayo's territory now?
Oh, I think they can handle it.
I want Simon Mayo coming after me, though.
You don't want him coming after you?
No, I met him once, and I've always found him a very warm broadcaster.
Oh.
And it's quite possible that he's a very warm human being.
Uh-huh.
But he seemed to take quite an intense disliking to me.
Fuck him. Had you said something mean about him?
No, I kind of like him.
Well, fuck him. Yeah. He's a piece of shit.
Mark Kermode, I worked with once. He seems like the more intimidating of the two.
Mm-hmm.
Couldn't have been lovelier.
Well, well, well. I bet he would like hearing that he's the favorite.
Who doesn't?
In any situation, people are always more open to having their friends bitched about than you might think, because then they get to feel like they're the good one.
So we're going to be talking about these films that we've watched this week. And our guest is the co-creator of a new sitcom on BBC Three. She is Ashley Story. It's called Dinosaur, which she's co-created with Matilda Curtis. She plays a young autistic woman in Glasgow. She herself is autistic. And it is great to see well-rounded autistic characters on TV. We have come a long way since Rain Man.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
It has not aged well. So our guest later, talking about Dinosaur, is Ashley Story. Take it away, Roger Ebert.
Here I go with my films this week. My quick watch was the Holocaust film, Zone of Interest. And I was instantly transfixed. It is the story of, I don't feel comfortable pronouncing the German name. Like, I'm not worried about insulting him. He was like a Nazi commander. But his name is Rudolf Hess. He was the Nazi commander of Auschwitz.
Can I ask, which word were you worried about the pronunciation of?
Hess.
Uh-huh. I mean, it's not one of history's most obscure names, but it is important to get these things right if you want to be a narrator of documentaries on the History Channel, as I know you do.
So what is different about this Holocaust film is that it focuses only on the perpetrators. The victims, you almost don't see them at all. You hear from them.
Mm.
It was directed by Jonathan Glazer. I didn't know much of his work other than Sexy Beast.
Which is fantastic. He did that film Under the Skin.
Yes, which I never saw.
You had a bee in your bonnet, I think, about Scarlett Johansson at the time.
Oh, yeah, well, I have a bee in my bonnet about Scarlett Johansson. So he has said that it's essentially like two films layered on each other, and one is visual and one is aural, A-U-R-A-L.
Mm.
And so you are seeing this very idyllic life that Rudolf Hess and his wife Hedwig have set up for themselves. And it's cycling with your children to school and playing in the babbling brooks and this exquisite garden that she has devoted herself to. The strange visual about it is that there's this one huge concrete wall, which is the garden sharing a wall with Auschwitz.
Right.
So from the second it started, I couldn't move because it was so riveting. And I needed to pee so bad. And I couldn't go pee because that's how compelling he's made this story, which is obviously not about humanizing Nazis. And I've read some interviews and he's been quite clear that that's not his intention. And in every little step, he made sure that humanizing wasn't what was going on. But the idea more of when we talk about monsters, who are we speaking about? And what does that look like on a sort of hour by hour basis?
So none of the glimpses of his domestic life made you feel any kind of empathy towards him?
No. You do see him as a very present father. But I personally feel that was undermined by the fact that he had five kids. Now, I understand there's a slightly different times quality to this, okay? But I have always believed if you have more than three kids, you're a crazy person.
I'm feeling very insulted on behalf of my maternal grandmother, Maggie, who had 12.
I think it's like self-abuse. But I didn't grow up in a time.
My maternal grandmother, Bessie, who had 7. And the Von Trapps. And the Waltons. Let me give you a different perspective. I had an Uber driver a few years ago. And to make small talk, I was asking him if he had kids. And he said he had 7 or whatever.
I
said, 7? That's a lot. He said, but your kids really love you, don't they? He said, yeah. So he said, why wouldn't you keep making new ones and you've got all these people who really love you?
Let me tell you why. Because there's a quality control issue here, okay?
What, your children?
Yeah.
If you keep going, you're going to get a bad one.
Yeah, like it's, I think it's crazy to think you could have 3 children and like none of them would be some kind of intense darkness, okay? I heard a dark thing once, and it's a parent is only as happy as their least happy child. And I think you start having 3, 4, 5 kids, good luck to you when they're all grown. Your whole life will be consumed by your fourth kid who like never quite did anything and is sad, okay? No more than 2 kids if you want my advice.
Even China has given up on the one child policy.
I'm not suggesting one child. I'm suggesting that once you go above 3, it is a representation, not of you like living a life, but of avoiding the life and starting to like actively affect the quality of life you can give per child.
Now, this is interesting because I think you and China have got to the same place with that number.
Oh, my God. Me and China? Really? Yes, yeah. I know politically it's not great.
Human rights.
Human rights not great.
All right. Let's bring it back from present day communist China to Nazi Germany in the film.
You guys, this film, your life is emptier without it. It will be very disturbing. I had nightmares last night. Literally, you will not sleep, but it's fucking worth it.
Okay, time for a gear change on the Cineast episode, because for my quick watch this week, I watched Unfrosted.
You've been so excited.
Which is Jerry Seinfeld's film for Netflix. It's set in the early 60s, and it's the race between Kellogg's and the Post cereal company to invent a heatable breakfast pastry, played very seriously as if it's the space race.
Right.
And you're right, I have been very excited and I have had a lot of fear. I mentioned this last week. I was worried about Jerry Seinfeld's ability to act as somebody other than Jerry Seinfeld. I was worried about too many star cameos spoiling the broth. I was worried about an exhausting amount of silliness. And I would say all of those fears were founded.
Uh-huh.
But I ended up kind of liking it.
Huh.
So Jerry Seinfeld, then, he acts a little bit like, you know, when they get the prime minister or the president to be in a sketch for charity. that's what his acting is like. He walks like somebody who's been told not to think about his arms. And of course, he directed it as well.
What did you make of the direction?
Here's what I thought. No scene outstays its welcome.
Oh, very Seinfeld.
The running time on this film, up until the point where the credits start to roll, 1 hour and 24 minutes.
So him.
I think in some ways that's another thing that messed with my expectations of this film, because he talks in a very precise way about the craft and the structure of comedy. And it is so insightful that you can't quite understand that he could make something that isn't just brilliant.
But he did it because he was bored in COVID. And this Seinfeld, former Seinfeld writer who's a friend, was like, let me pitch you on this. So this is not Seinfeld trying to be excellent. I think he did this to try something new and because he was bored.
And the thing that he was pitched by that writer, Spike Ferriston, was a movie version of one of his stand-up bits about the invention of the Pop-Tart.
Right.
And that got me thinking, is there IP in just bits of stand-up? And I thought, what about when were you 22 years old when you first tried a bit of stand-up? 22?
Yeah.
And you did it for a few months and then you stopped for many years.
Yeah.
Didn't you have a bit that you could pitch as a film?
I don't even know exactly what you're driving to, but everything about that period is so humiliating.
Didn't you have a bit about a talking anus?
Oh, I did. But may I be candid? I think I stole that, not from another comic, but I was waitressing at the time. And there was this one waitress I was friendly with, and she would make her mouth really tight and then talk like she was a butthole. And I was like, would you mind if I did that on stage? So I think I talked like a butthole. And then also I did a thing where I enacted foreskin, like as the penis head emerged because of a sweater I bought I'd seen.
So you're wearing like a turtleneck sweater.
A cowl neck. I'm wearing a cowl neck sweater that I remember treating myself to from Anthropology.
I think you could pitch both of those things to Seth MacFarlane.
Can I just say I was 22 years old and I'd never gotten on stage before? And it's very scary.
We said there is this concern about this film being a bit too starry. I actually don't think that's really its problem. And there's some great performers in there. Jim Gaffigan, Melissa McCarthy, Amy Schumer, Peter Dinklage, Christian Slater, Bill Burr. I think he steals the thing. And there's a great surprise cameo.
So I think I know who the surprise cameo is. It's Hugh Grant.
Oh, Hugh Grant is in it as well. He isn't the surprise cameo. He's very funny in it. He plays a mascot. He plays Tony the Tiger. Have you ever done any mascotting?
Surprisingly, I have not. Do you know what I think it is? Think about how I respond to temperatures. The whole idea feels very suffocating in a way that I don't think of as me.
Yes, I once danced on stage with the flaming lips dressed as either a monkey or a dog.
Wow.
And I got very hot. The other people in the mascot costumes were going off to hydrate, but I was professional. I stayed on stage the whole time.
Did you faint?
No, but I felt very unwell.
Yeah.
For days.
I think that's what's kept me away from that situation.
So as well as Hugh Grant as Tony the Tiger, you see lots of other cereal mascots like Snap, Crackle and Pop from Rice Krispies, The Kellogg's Rooster, the Quaker from Quaker Oats.
My mother loved Quaker Oats to the extent that, because she didn't like the aesthetic of the box, which I respect. So she would decant the Quaker Oats into some kind of thing that was like sat there. So it's like olive oil, salt, pepper, Quaker Oats.
So was it the image of the Quaker in her house that made her feel uneasy?
Oy, I just get the heebie-jeebies. Oy, it was so Gentile.
So I think I watched this film in a very specific way. I think I was desperate for it to be good and petrified it would be awful. And I'm not sure that either of those things are conducive to a typical viewing experience.
Sure.
But I think it's fun. There's a lot of lovely turns of phrase. There's a lot of funny ideas. There aren't that many big laughs.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a bit like when you see a stand-up comedian who's got some really good ideas for a premise for a joke, but without the punchlines. And the thing I would liken it to the most, in a way that both is and isn't a compliment, is it's like watching a Muppet movie without any Muppets in it.
That sounds horrible, but I accept that this film was not horrible.
We'd love to hear from you. What are your thoughts on our opinions on the films or Sarah's opinions on Number of Children?
Can I just say really fast, as I was doing that, I remembered a couple of listeners who have emailed in with different stuff and including details that they have 5 kids. And I just want to say to those listeners, so amazing to contribute to our pod, I was not talking about you. I think you're the exception that proves the rule. I love you so much. Please email again. Please don't stop listening. Please love me.
I'll tell you what I'd like to hear from people on. Mm-hmm. What is the biggest marital difference in the thing that you individually are always in the mood to watch?
That's good.
Yeah. Is one of you always in the mood for a somber reflection on the Holocaust and the other one is always in the mood for property shows?
Yeah, that's interesting.
Any film recommendations? Is it worth going back to Under the Skin despite Sarah's B in the B about SJ?
Scarlett Jo.
Great cameos in TV or film.
Mm.
And your general recommendations. The email address is
fuckoff@firecrotchandnormcore.com.
How are you doing?
Not enough people joined the Patreon to help me see my dad's body more times before he dies.
I'm sorry.
It's okay.
Maybe that isn't the incentive they needed.
If every person who listens to the podcast did what they could, I could see my dad before he dies. He's in perfect health.
Are you amassing good data on what is most effective for Patreon recruitment? So is it hedges? Mm-hmm. Is it your unnecessary under eye bag surgery?
Uh-huh.
Is it getting to see your dad more times before his demise?
I would say this proves that maybe I shouldn't be using my father's death as a way of trying to get essentially a flight to Chicago is too big. I should know that going in. It's too big. There was a week where I talked a lot about a manicure I wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, if 10 of you join, I can get this dream manicure. Mm-hmm. And a few people were like, you got me with that manicure.
So and you know where the level is.
I think that's because it was like cheap and you could see it for me. There's no rhyme or reason. What are you going to get? You're going to get your voice note. You're going to get extended interview. You can get a birthday video from my mom. And most of all, the sense of reward that there's something you enjoy. And you just think, here's a little something, something to make it easier. Let me do my part. Have you done your part? Have you joined the Patreon? If not, springtime, new life, new opportunities. Do it now.
Patreon.com/they like to watch. And coming up later, our guest is Ashley Story. She is the co-creator of and star of BBC Three's Dinosaur. She plays a paleontologist. I don't think I've ever met a paleontologist in real life.
No, me neither. I haven't.
But I'd like to.
Yeah. Oh, they seem weird.
I think it seems like a nice job.
You know what I think could be a happy job for someone is a geologist.
Looking at rocks.
It's never appealed to me, but I thought, I bet if that's what you want to do, How wonderful.
But you're not digging the rocks out of the ground yourself. You're not an archaeologist.
No, not an archaeologist, a geologist.
Somebody else is cleaning the dirt off them.
Yeah, although I've also thought that archaeology could be fun.
No.
Takes you too much away from your family.
No, I just don't want to get dirty.
I don't mind getting dirty. I don't like huge amounts of mud, but I don't think that's what they're dealing with. I think they're digging into drier earth.
Are you sure about that, aren't you?
I know a little bit about it because when I was a kid, I went through an archaeology chapter.
But aren't you just thinking about archaeology as something that happens in Egypt or yes. very arid places, yes. not in Somerset?
I don't think until this very moment it occurred to me that archaeology took place anywhere other than Egypt.
You wanted to be an Egyptologist.
I wanted to be an Egyptologist.
Our guest later, TV paleontologist in the new sitcom Dinosaur, it's Ashley Story. The film that we cineasts watched together was Anatomy of a Fall. It had been recommended to us a few times, won a couple of Oscars, including Best Foreign Film, I think. Let's set the scene. We are in Grenoble.
Grenoble. I don't know how to do that one.
In the French Alps. We're in a very, I would say, chalet-like house.
Yeah.
And our protagonist, Sandra, who is a writer, is being interviewed by a young student about her work. After a few minutes, very loud music starts blaring from the loft. It's just one tune on repeat. And Sandra explains that this is her husband, Samuel. He's working up there. This is a thing that he does. And they'd best pick up this another time. The student leaves. A little later, we see Sandra and Samuel's 11-year-old son, Daniel, return from walking the dog to discover his dad's dead body on the ground in the snow. And the loft window is open. And we're off from there. The film is an investigation and a trial. But what happened? And specifically, did Sandra push him? How was that for a synopsis?
I thought it was really, really good.
Thank you. Thank you. But from the off, let's establish it's so much more than a courtroom drama. What it is a brilliant dissection mm-hmm. of the insides of a marriage.
It's that sort of invisible acting thing. It's this real sense that you're just lurking in someone's life. And even as you're reading, because it's a mix of subtitled and not subtitled, because they're speaking a mix of English and French, the lines that you're seeing and hearing, like I felt that the woman who wrote this film was expressing certain ideas to do with relationship dynamics so well. That I was like writing them down.
To use against me in an argument in the future.
Nope.
Because here, I think, is the question for every couple watching this film. If one of us was found dead and a jury got to eavesdrop and rummage around in our lives, even the day before it had happened, what percentage of days would make you look capable of murdering your spouse?
And it takes this like really extreme situation to just sort of say in a long-term relationship, how much are you to blame for all the things in your life that make you angry? And how much is like you've got this other person and they are fucking wearing you down. And that's not fair.
The lead actor is astonishing. She's called Sandra Huller. And in fact, you love this film so much that you then went and watched another of her films, Zone of Interest, which you did for your quick watch.
I don't understand how I didn't know her name until now. She's the star of like the two best films of the year. You couldn't believe you're watching someone act.
So she plays a writer. Uh-huh. Do you think writers are overrepresented?
Yeah, of course. But, you know, we know why this is.
Well, is it because you should write what you know, so writers find it easy to write writers? Or is it because everybody feels they've got a book inside of them and a writer is an aspirational job?
Well, it's yes and yes, right? Everyone has a book inside of them. Probably you don't have the ability to make your inside book anything that another person would benefit from.
So Sandra is a successful writer. Her late husband, it turns out, was an aspiring writer.
Oh, dangerous.
And I don't think this is too much of a spoiler, but one of the details that emerges is one of her successful books is based on a kernel of a discarded idea that he had had.
Yes. And her point was it was a brilliant idea. Which, by the way, I didn't think it was a brilliant idea. You find out at one point what it is, and I was like, not that good. No. But he had abandoned it, and he can't execute properly.
He'll never pull it together to do anything with this idea.
Which, like, is not actually flattering. You think if someone is like, oh, could I steal that from you? That's so brilliant. Different situation, that'd be so flattering. But in that situation, it's like, can I steal it from you because I know you lack the ability to execute properly?
Because it's the opposite in our marriage. I often have little ideas that you could do in your stand-up act, but you don't seem very interested in them a lot of the time.
Sometimes I just think I'm the wrong person for that.
I said to you just last week, don't you think there's something funny about an under new management sign on a business? The passive aggression of that.
Yeah, but I truly think with something like that...
Put it in the act.
I don't think that's quite my thing. I wish it was.
You're letting me down gently.
No. Well, I mean, so, yeah, I guess it's the best, I think, honey, you just don't have an instinct for what could work. And that could never fucking work. And you think it's like a nice line. But like, you can't just say a nice line.
I once gave a eulogy and got a lot of laughs.
Exactly, because of the expectation.
The song that the husband's playing in the loft on a loop, it comes up time and time again in the film. It is like a steel band dub version of a 50 Cent song.
Uh-huh. Do you want to try singing it right now, honey?
I shan't.
Okay.
But it is just stuck in my head all the time.
Yeah.
Did the volume at which he likes his music put you in mind of me? But so he was very, doing it aggressive. It was an act of aggression. It was an act of aggression.
Yeah, so it's never very early on in my relationship with my husband. I remember we were walking on the Upper West Side. You know when like you're like in the first year, let's say, or probably 6 months that you know the person you wind up married to, you hear these little pieces of information and you don't understand as you're hearing them that they will become the pillars of your life that you have to like settle around and accommodate. We were walking on the Upper West Side of Manhattan and you were like, a thing about me, which is maybe not great, is like one of the things that makes me the angriest is if I'm told to turn my music down. And at the time, I wanted to be the most beloved woman of his life ever. And I thought, well, I'll just make sure to never tell this man to turn his music down because I wanted to feel respected. It is now one of the things that makes me the craziest.
You always listen to your podcast at full volume?
And what do I do?
I don't know.
I make sure to close all doors so that my husband is not unnecessarily affected. Like, you really are averse to noise pollution and no one can comment on your noise pollution.
What a charming paradox.
Well, you know, I'm not even that angry. Well, no, I guess I am. But in your next marriage, early on, you'll say something about noise control. And this lady will be like, absolutely not. Sorry, you're a grown man. You can be told to turn your music down and you'll go, oh shit, I wonder if I've been wrong all along. And my dead wife had a point. And so to whoever that next wife is, if I get some kind of surprise disease, fucking heaven forbid, you mold this next part of him, okay?
I am always trying to grow and get better.
You are, absolutely.
But there's only so far I can go in this marriage.
I've never known anyone who works on themselves as well as you do. I really mean that. I want to say that nice thing after really digging into you, but it's very sincere.
Do you know that song wasn't the first choice?
Oh.
So they wanted a really well-known song, but they couldn't clear it.
What? Go on.
And I don't think it would be as good a film.
Go on.
Jolene.
What?
Yes.
Huh. Here's what. That film is so great that I bet if we'd experienced that, it would have felt completely uncheesy and completely perfect. But it feels a little too on the nose.
Do you think that this film would make every married couple watching it uncomfortable? Or do you think it makes us uncomfortable?
It made us uncomfortable, right? Yeah. There were like a few too many pieces that felt a little too close. I mean, I don't know. You guys, please watch this, especially if you're married, and tell me if it made you squirm a little bit. Can you admit now? You don't have to, or I might be barking up the wrong tree. We had a really nice day together yesterday, and then the mood shifted. Now, we didn't descend into a mad argument, but just there was just a little ick in the air. And I had felt like it was because it was too uncomfortable of a film to watch together in a way.
Yes.
But what may I say, it's not quite like I'm her and you're him.
No.
She had some of me to her and he had some of him to you, I would say.
She was a writer who likes working from bed. I like working from bed.
You like working from bed. Did that make you feel really good?
Yeah. He likes a project. You like a project.
Love a project. Right. So it wasn't quite as clear as you're him, I'm her. But there were just a lot of different personality aspects. I was like, I've got that. He's got that.
Made me think that I should maybe turn my music down a bit so I can hear you coming.
Ever try to kill you? I don't think I will try to kill you. I think like something could happen where I slapped your face one time. But I think that's as extreme as I think I could go.
Then life still has some surprises in store then, right?
I'm not going to slap you.
Or kill me.
No, I'm not going to kill you.
Listen, if what you like watching is the psychodynamics of people's relationships, this is of the finest magnitude.
It felt as I was watching it, I was like, this will go down in history as a favorite. In 20 years, I'm going to be saying, well, one of my favorite films is Anatomy of a Fall. Don't miss it. And do tell me if it was uncomfortable to watch with your partner.
As Sarah asked, did you recognize your own relationship in there? Also, Justine Triet. Who is she? What else has she done? Is her oeuvre worth exploring? Email us.
Fuck off at firecrotchandnormcore.com.
And coming up next, to talk about the sitcom Dinosaur, which is on BBC Three and BBC iPlayer now, it's Ashley Story.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
I can tell you that your Wikipedia includes the detail that she was also sacked from a law firm for stacking cans of Coke into a pyramid during a meeting with Japanese clients.
Yes. True story. I was a temp and I used to get bored and I would pretend I was in I Love Lucy and set up skits for myself.
Were you sort of knowingly doing this with people able to observe you, or were you like, you thought you were having a private moment and then someone walked in?
No, I worked as a temp and I was undiagnosed as autistic, and the only way I could cope with being a temp was to have a character for every job I worked at. And I just was like a silly woman at the law office, and I did quirky things like build a pyramid out of cans. It was all very performative, but it was the only way I could get through my job.
Wow. And what other characters have you used? You know, now you understand it, I guess, as a form of masking, yeah. But what other characters have you used in real life like that?
I've spoken about this before, but I used to work for East Renfrewshire Council as a tea girl. And I played like just a really silly, pretty girl who was really dim. And I just constantly was inept. And I realised, it was the first time I realised that if you speak in a baby voice and say you don't know how to do something, somebody will just do it for you rather than show you. It was a really weird discovery, because I'd always been really self-sufficient and quite straightforward and, oh, I'll do it myself. And I just one day was like, I don't know how to put the oven on, and a man climbed in and did it for me, and I thought, oh, that's how that works. And it took me a really long time to get there. I just pretend who I need to pretend to be to get through whatever situation I'm in.
So what's the story with Dinosaur? How long had you been working on it? How do you and your co-creator Matilda Curtis know each other?
Matilda wrote a pilot that two brothers, Sarah Hammond, who is their exec, she picked up, and they were kind of did an open casting looking for any neurodiverse actors in their 20s based in England. And my agent contacted the casting lady and was like, look, she's in her 30s and she's based in Scotland, but I have a client who is very autistic. Would you like to meet her? and I did a self-tape where I recorded all of the voices and then edited it together because I didn't have anybody to tape with because it was during lockdown. And I sent it away, and then I had a meeting with Sarah, and then suddenly it's the middle of lockdown and I'm filming a pilot in Glasgow with a massive camera team, and it was super weird, and I had no creative input at this point. I was just an actor in a pilot, and then that got kind of put on BBC Three, put on BBC One. There was a little bit of interest, but nobody really had anything to say. And then about a year and a half, 2 years ago, I got a phone call saying Hulu were interested and that they were going to co-produce it with BBC. And would I like to come on board with as a creator with Matilda? Because if it's going to be set in Scotland and I'm actually autistic, and would I like to have more of an input in the actual autism-y and Scottish-y side of it? And I said yes, and then it kind of just grew from there, and that's how it went about.
But is that a bit like an arranged marriage then? So you weren't collaborators who grew this thing from the start. You were put together, it was her show, and then they wanted your perspective as an autistic person and a Scottish person in it.
I think that it's actually a lot more common in television than people think, is you have somebody comes to you with an idea and you're like, yeah, but I'd like something else in it. I'm going to add this person.
When you got invited to participate in the, you know, the creative side of it beyond just acting in it, did that feel a little bit like dreams coming true?
I didn't want to be an actor. I wanted to be an actor when I was a kid, and then as I got older, I desperately wanted to be Aaron Sorkin, which is so fucking ridiculous, but that's who I wanted to be. Wanted to write like really wordy television with big long walk and talks. And I went to university and I studied like script writing and filmmaking, and that was my dream. And then I realised that there was not a lot of opportunity for that in Scotland. And
how pretentious did you get as a film student?
I was very much more, because at the time I was the only person in my film class who was uploading to YouTube. So I was already doing like vlogs and blogs. So I was a lot more thinking in short form clips, sketches, than the actual long form of it all. So when I got to university, as much as I wanted to be Aaron Sorkin, I saw from the get-go the value in the internet before anybody else did. And I was bombarding YouTube and podcasts with just clips of my mum and clips of stand-up comedy.
But don't you think that so many people in broadcast media still think like that? Only they understand YouTube a little bit now, but they don't understand that people are watching more video than ever before, but they're watching it on their phones, and what's on the TV is more akin to having the fire on than it is to watching shows these days.
I think it's because, and I have theories about this, but a lot of the kids who are coming up from film school have left film school, any of the ones who have talent, and have gone straight to editing for content creators, where they get paid a lot of money.
Wow.
To edit for really good big content creators. I know that like loads of YouTubers in London just scoop up good editors, like they're a hot commodity just now. So those kids who would go in and change stuff at the BBC or change stuff at Channel 4, they're not going there because they're getting paid a lot more to go to some prankster's YouTube channel and do slight transitions. Yeah.
But you hear, I mean, like an extension of that, I guess, is like you'll hear about these very successful podcasts, and then they're called into some channel for a meeting and they say, we want to put you on the screen, and it's going to be 6 episodes. We'll pay you a fraction of what you get from your advertising revenue on your podcast, and you won't have the control you have with your podcast. What on earth at that point is the incentive for those people to go and do a show for the Dave Channel or Comedy Central?
I don't think there is. I've had those meetings myself, Jeff, where I've gone in and they're like, we love your Harry Potter video. How can we turn that into a TV show? And I'm like, well, you can't, because it's a 3-minute Harry Potter video of me shouting swear words. So that isn't going to translate to nothing. That's just, it's just a video. And they don't want sketch shows like old sketch shows. So the things that could work, which is turning viral videos into sketches, they don't want.
Yeah, but I suppose what it is would people watch that on television when there are so many people doing it and doing it well online. You're right, you could split a sketch show into 10 or 12 chunks, put them all on TikTok or Reels, and they'd get more viewers than they'd ever get on TV. But how is Channel 4 making money out of that? How are they sustaining their business?
Do they not get ad revenue? I don't know what the ad revenue for big channels like that, but they must be get, because I know that Jimmy Kimmel, Jimmy Fallon, all that lot, when they do so much better on YouTube than they actually do on the channels that they're on. So they must be making, you must be making ad revenue.
But with Nina being autistic and understanding herself as an autistic person, I think it's such a great thing to have on television, and shows like Dinosaur are great from that perspective. So she understands herself as an autistic person. Your diagnosis was later in life. What were the things where you went, oh, that explains why I've been like this my entire life?
So I diagnosed my dad when I was 16. I was in school and I got given the Baron-Cohen test just because I was doing higher psychology, and the Baron-Cohen test was kind of the standard test for Asperger's. And I'm reading this list and it's like, do you struggle to talk on the phone because you don't know when the conversation ends? I remember that's the one that stuck out at me, because I was like, my dad refuses to speak on a phone. He'll give me the phone and he'll stand beside me and tell me what to say, because he can't bear to talk on the phone. And it was always really stressful. And my dad had a lot of these angry outbursts and he was having a lot of depression. And I was constantly looking for reasons for his mental health problems. And my mum had just started touring doing comedy. So she was in New Zealand for like 2 months of the year. And I was left to kind of look after him. And I'm 16 and I don't know what's going on. And I find this list and I'm like, that's dad. And he went to the GP that week. And he was like, I think I have this thing called Asperger's. And the GP was like, I think you might be right, my friend. That explains a lot. And then he got so fast. It was such a fast thing for him that it was so different than everybody else's experience. Because like literally his medical professionals, who'd been really struggling with his mental health as well, were like, oh, we know where to send you now. And he got diagnosed super quickly. He got a psychotherapist who, you know, helped him understand it. And he went from this man who didn't leave his bed for about 6 years to a functioning man who understood himself. And then as I sort of drew away and became my own person and started being characters to cope in the outside world and other little things, I was like, oh, I think I might be autistic. But I went to my doctor. I said to him, do you think I have the same thing as my dad? And he said, look, you can work. Don't get diagnosed. It'll impact your ability to get a job. So just keep doing what you're doing. People like you are just like that. I remember that was my GP's exact words. People like you are just like that. And I was like, okay, he was a very old man. I hold no grudges against him.
Yeah,
I remember once I was like, I think I'm sitting funny at my computer desk. Do I have a hunch? And he was like, are you a detective? And I thought, okay, you're not a GP. You're like a lounge comic from the 1960s.
Oh, man, that's great.
But so I just kind of went about in my head for all this time going, I'm autistic, but I'm not going to tell anybody. I'm just going to keep pretending and hopefully nobody will notice. And I would get really offended if anybody asked me. And
why would you get so... What was that offence coming from if you knew yourself and you didn't feel shame about it?
I did feel shame about it. That's why I was pretending to be other people. It was I thought, I was like, I'm trying so hard to be normal. How could you possibly see that in me?
When you think about that advice that the doctor gave you of like, you don't need an official diagnosis here, because in some ways that would be unhelpful. How do you think about that now? Do you think there's any value in that perspective, or does it just feel really regressive and wrong?
I think it's regressive and wrong, because when I played Nina and when I wrote Nina, I wrote her as a woman who's known she's autistic and has been accepted that she's autistic her whole life. And because she's been allowed to be, I feel like there's parts of her in me that are stunted that in her have thrived.
Do you feel that playing her was in any way therapeutic? Like, can you take a little bit of that character and keep her with you?
I think like... certainly with just how I was allowed to physically be as Nina, I was allowed to like move my hands how I wanted. I mean, I'm doing it now, but I was allowed to like fiddle and stem, and that was never frowned upon.
Is it a correct assumption that prior to Dinosaur, you hadn't acted at all? You had no prior acting experience, is that right?
I had bits and pieces, like from, I was a child advert actor. So I did like fairy adverts and stuff when I was like five.
Where's that coming from? Was that you had these show business dreams as a kid, or was it coming from your parents?
My first ever acting role was because she had gone for an audition and I was like miming her behind her while she was trying to get a part in this short film. And the director was like, said something to me like, do something. And I just did what he told me to. And I was a very amenable child, so they put me in this short film that my mum didn't get a part in. My parents were like, you're going to go to school and you're going to, because I had been like, I'm going to be an actor. I'm going to be on Casualty and The Bill. And my parents were like, no, you're going to go to this private school where you're going to get educated. And we've saved up all our money and that's what you're going to do. And in my first year of school, aged five, Ken Loach came to my school to find actors for an advert he was making. And then I got taken
out of
school.
Hang on. I think this is a scoop. Ken Loach came looking in a private school.
Loach came looking at a private school when he was making adverts for Fairy Liquid.
Okay.
In the documentary of his life, he refers to the period of time he worked with me as one of the darkest.
Without naming you specifically.
Because he was having to do all of the things he hated in life, working on adverts with private school children.
Do you think if your mum hadn't started doing comedy and had this rise as a stand-up comedian in her own right, she would have become one of those pushy stage mums?
Well, she was borderline.
Living it out of, really?
Yeah, I love my mum very much, and people know that I love my mum very much, but we had a very symbiotic relationship. So I say she was a pushy stage mum, but I was a pushy stage daughter. I was like at every fringe being like, tighten up, I've got notes
for you. But how did you know to, like, what did you think that made you then go, Ma, we got to fix this shit?
Nothing. It was just solely like,
just instinct?
Me and Mum, we're alone in this. She wasn't really favoured by the comedy circuit. She didn't have friends in the comedy circuit. She wasn't like, you see comedians and they go out and they post selfies and they're all in big groups and they're happy. She was never part of that. She was a mum. Mm. She didn't drink. She was a woman at that time. She was probably the only woman in most dressing rooms. And there was kind of like, I think, a security of her taking me to these gigs. Because if you've got your kid with you, people aren't going to be as rude or whatever.
How has she felt about the success of your show and you having a show in the first place?
I think she's delighted. I think she's really happy. I think there's a little bit of me that feels sad because I know that was like her dream and she never got to have that, but at the same time my mum is, in terms of work, she's the opposite of me. She walks on stage and she just says words and they're funny and she doesn't try. She doesn't write material down. She's never written a joke down in her life. She's never written a fringe show down. She just goes, nah, I'll make it up when I get there. And that's what she does every year.
Are you done with the fringe now that you're a TV star, baby?
I don't have any love for the fringe. I have love for a load of the people in it and I miss seeing them every year, but I think that there is something mad nefarious and heart destroying, and I feel sad when I see these kids who have so many big dreams and are spending all of their money for this thing that's not going to treat them well in return.
So if not the fringe, then what's next? Is it more Dinosaur?
I mean, I'd hope to do more Dinosaur. I've got a couple of jobs since Dinosaur, working on different scripts and writing, which is kind of like the thing I love doing the most.
What are you watching at the moment?
We returned to YouTube. I grew up on YouTube, so as much as television is great and I'll watch an episode of something, I'd much rather watch like an episode of Law and Order on double speed on Facebook. I'm kidding. I do that though. Do you ever see those videos where they're all really talking really fast, but it's really short? Wait, I watch them.
So explain to me.
No, but people listen to podcasts like that as well. People often listen to podcasts on 1.5 or 2 times speed.
Yeah, yeah. So I can get it quicker, feed my brain faster.
So give me a classic part of YouTube that Ashley is visiting for entertainment.
Like, where are you starting? Do you go to the homepage? Are you looking at recommended? Are you typing something into the search box? How does it happen?
So YouTube-wise, I'll watch Philip DeFranco. That's where I'll get my news. And then I'll watch probably something foodie. So my sidebar will have like recommended videos from my people I subscribe to who have just uploaded. So then I'll watch Sorted Food and I'll watch people test kitchen gadgets. And then I'll watch The Side Men because apparently I'm a 15-year-old boy trapped in an adult woman's body. And then I'll watch boxing. And then I'll end up somehow watching people build sim houses.
What appeals to you about boxing?
I like boxing because I like watching amateur boxing because it's funny. I like watching hockey, ice hockey, because I didn't know you were legally allowed to fight in that. And I kept thinking they were going to get in trouble and they didn't. And somebody explained to me that's because they're allowed to.
Oh my God.
It's so fun.
Our thanks to Ashley. I feel so plugged in and connected to youth culture after talking to Ashley.
And it's not like she's 14 or something, but I just feel like she's one of these people who just sort of connects to what the new thing is. That's a very impressive quality.
I want to be more plugged in like Ashley, though. I mean, do you think I should start hanging around with some teenagers?
No. You could try to start hanging around with her, but she lives in Glasgow and probably doesn't want a friend who's 51.
Dinosaur is available to watch on BBC iPlayer now.
Take it to the inbox, to the inbox. Here we are in the inbox. This first email is from Anne Bennett.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm very excited to include this because I got real hate mail this week. And I only ever feel, I mean, it does feel like someone has just sort of, you've opened up your lovely little sweet spot of just sweetness and loveliness and our listeners who care enough to email in. And then it's like someone's just like slapped me in the face.
Did you send hate mail back to the person who'd sent you hate mail?
No, because I think that people that write in with hateful thoughts to be like, you need to hear this from me, is someone who's kind of mentally unwell. And I don't feel the need to prove how poorly founded their points are because they're having a hard time. And I, you know, go with God.
You're leading with love.
Go with God, lead with love. Go with God, lead with love. So this is Jeff's hate mail. I said to Jeff, did you see my hate mail? He went, I got hate mail. I said, no, you didn't. This is Jeff's hate mail. Dear FNN, devoted potty stroke, Patreon stroke, comedy gig folks here. Already, they're really backing whatever they're about to say, aren't they? I am piping up in indignant defense of the love fest that is Piano, the megastar Mika, and all the carefully invited pianists. Format not as dumb as you seem to think, Jeff. And stretching a point here, would Succession season 2 be so awesome if we skipped season 1? No, I'll just say real fast, having not watched any of the Piano at all, and I'm like so up for this, like you coming from my husband, I support you. I feel the Succession comparison is insane.
You can't really compare a narrative drama with a reality show in that way, which is designed for people to dip
she
into.
She says, I know I'm stretching a point here, but you're including it as part of your defense. So I'm just saying I'm sort of starting off on your team, but that shifted me to my hubby's team and the concerts, etc. Yep. So, as my late Yorkshire dad would say, think on. We do love you, honest. Three kisses.
Yeah. So it's hate mail with a bit of love in it.
Yeah.
Which I'm more receptive to.
Yeah. And she tried to say, look, this is coming from someone who really likes you, which only makes it hurt more.
Yes. Yeah.
It feels like hate mail because she loves you.
I still think it's hyperbolic to describe Mika as a pop superstar.
Before you go any further, Jeff, why don't you read the next email?
Okay. This comes from Tom, who says, hi, FC and NC. I don't disagree with any of Jeff's observations on the Piano Series 2. However, I do think Series 1 was one of the most genuinely excellent, heartwarming and life-affirming things I have seen on TV for years. And that is speaking as a bitter, cynical, middle-aged Succession superfan. It would be impossible to repeat what made it special now that the cat's out of the bag about the format. This was what I was saying.
Very well expressed.
And he says, side note, glad Jeff also called out the description of Mika as a pop superstar. I can't remember exactly what they called him in Series 1, but it was even worse. Global pop sensation or some such bullshit. My girlfriend and I were yelling at the telly every time they said it. This is the thing that annoys me about TV. It treats us like idiots. Mm-hmm, I'm pleased to see Mika.
Sure.
I enjoyed him on the Eurovision Song Contest the other year.
Great.
Don't patronise me by calling him a pop superstar. You can call him pop star.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you've no problem with a pop star.
But my point
They're pushing too hard and you don't like it.
There's something about the way the show was put together, even though I liked a lot of the individual parts, some of the production was horrible, and that is symptomatic of that.
And he's not trying to have the last word here. He's just sharing his feelings.
I said last week, I just want to address Anne with love. I did say last week, I find some of the stories so moving, but I felt it was undermined by some of the choices they were making.
Here's what can happen.
How they put that program together.
We had this issue with The Bear. I think Anne felt looked down on because she really liked it. So to hear someone going, here's all this shit that's wrong with it, you feel a little... I don't know, if I'm watching something and thinking, this is lovely, and then you start bashing it, I'm like, shut the fuck up. I think Anne felt like, shut the fuck up. And, you know, from a place of love.
Okay, Anne, I hope we can find some peace.
Okay, on to one last topic, which I think is important, from Tom.
He says, also delighted to hear Sarah enthusing about The Bureau, which is definitely one of the best shows of the last 10 years. As a complete piece of work, I'd put it slightly above Slow Horses.
Fascinating.
Great as that show is too. Well, Slow Horses, it's not a complete piece of work yet, is it?
So nope.
You have to see where they land it.
But I thought putting your head above the parapet, as people say.
I say that.
I never say it. That's why I felt uncomfortable as it came out.
I used it twice in one day the other day, and I had to pull myself up on it. Yeah.
Okay.
I might need to impose a moratorium in saying putting your head above the parapet for the time being.
It's good that you can see that in yourself. This next email comes from Martha, who writes, Dear FC and NC, longtime listener from Succession Days, first time emailer. I must admit to being a little overawed by the standard of correspondence you guys seem to receive, and have never felt like I had a hot enough take or an interesting enough submission to make it to the hallowed inbox.
Look at you now, Martha.
Look at you now, Martha. Also one of my favorite names for a woman. Saying that, I think I might just have found something fresh. If by fresh, I mean a 1990s documentary that's been available on iPlayer for years. It's called Signs of the Times and is a collaboration between director Nick Barker and photographer Martin Parr, and it's just a wonderful piece of filmmaking. It features mainly couples sitting on their sofa talking to the camera about their home decor choices, and is a fascinating, almost voyeuristic slice of life. Like if Gogglebox let you see Giles and Mary's downstairs toilet. It's so much the kind of thing I feel Jeff will enjoy that I could well be preaching to the converted here. But the mixture of social history and barely hidden invitation to go fully ahead and judge these people and their bad taste / snobbery / toxic relationship dynamics is, I feel, something you will both get something out of.
That sounds fantastic. I love
so
Martin Parr. Martin Parr's one of my favorites. I don't know how I missed that. That sounds great.
I'll start doing the Patreon thing once my sad and depressing divorce finally gets finalized. He was never a fan of the best power. He was never a fan of the best power couple around, and that says it all. Fuck that guy, Martha.
I hope we were mentioned in the divorce petition.
Oh yeah, same.
I just don't like it.
Fuck you. Love ya, Martha. Kiss, kiss. Good luck on the divorce. You'll get there, and I believe it most often, and certainly in your case, it's an act of bravery.
And your brother emails.
Am I reading him?
You can do the voice, I guess, better than
okay,
I can.
Okay, this is from my brother. Real, real fast, real hot, real quick.
Amidst all the hullabaloo,
I can never do it under pressure. I'm surprised more people aren't mentioning the reemergence of the woman who plays Hugh Grant's chief of staff in Love Actually. My brother is obsessed with Love Actually. He watched it every day for, I think, a full semester of college. So he knows it frame by frame and line by line. He says, yes, that's her playing the ex-girlfriend's mother with whom Richard Gadd is living. So Hugh Grant goes, perhaps talking about
Martin McCutcheon.
Yes.
Who we saw on Blackety Blank the other night.
Yes. And actually, my brother's email was, she has very sizable thighs, sir, because all the fucking film is about how she's fat. It's insane. So that same actor says, she has very sizable thighs, sir. And then Hugh Grant, when he's getting too overwhelmed with his affection for her and wondering if it's complicating things, says to this woman, perhaps she could be reassigned. And the woman goes, I have to really take the beat. This is good. I can't do him, but I can do her. It's done, sir. Now, I just did a tip of my head that is fucking tight.
Are we encouraging other people to send us unlikely connections to Love Actually?
If only my brother is allowed to send in unlikely connections to Love Actually.
But fill our inbox with love.
And sweetness and support and not hate.
The email address is
fuckoff@firecrotchandnormcore.com.
This week, Ashley Story liked to watch old episodes of Law and Order on double speed on Facebook. And Philip DeFranco, hockey, boxing, The Sidemen, kitchen gadgets, and people building sim houses on YouTube. Sarah watched Zone of Interest on Amazon Prime. I watched Unfrosted on Netflix. And we watched Anatomy of a Fall on Amazon Prime.
Well, there's a big thing coming up this week. Eurovision! I've taken Saturday night off so I can watch it with my husband and my son. Jeff will make some different dishes from different countries. All that really means is you make a Swedish potato. And I encourage you this week, my darling and my love, to try and bring a positive energy to the process of cooking. Jeff is a very good cook, but the problem is you get so stressed and so focused that it, instead of the lovely energy you picture in a house as someone prepares a meal, it's like this toxic black cloud permeates, and then a plate of food is sat down on the table and you have to very quickly be like, oh my God, this is so amazing, this is so amazing. And then Jeff starts to resettle and then I go clean the kitchen. So we're not going to focus on that part. We're going to focus on we'll eat some delicious potatoes. Who am I rooting for? I guess I am going to root for Ali Alexander because I think he's such a darling boy. So I guess I'm supporting Britain. But will that change as I observe other countries? You do your fun thing. Maybe you have a day off work. I wish you all the very best.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.